Hi, this is John Udell. My guest for today's podcast is Bob Glushko. His background is in electronic publishing and e-business infrastructure. He's the author with Tim McGrath of a new book called Document Engineering. We talked about information architecture, semantics, tagging, and business pattern languages like RosettaNet and UBL, the Universal Business Language. At Berkeley, where Bob teaches, he's training a generation of students to think in terms of these pattern languages and design information systems based on them.
John, this is Bob Glushko.
Hey, Bob, how you doing?
Okay, it's hot as hell out here, but I guess it is out there, too.
Finally, I'm not complaining. Let's see, I'm not sure exactly where to start.
Well, I've been wondering how you plan to describe me, because I'm not sure how I would describe myself.
Well, how do you want to be described?
Let's see. I suspect that I've tried with something like I'm an entrepreneur turned academic, but that's not quite right because I think I'm a pretty entrepreneurial academic.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to make it seem like there's all or none. I've been really lucky to go to a place at Berkeley where they let me do my own thing and be extremely flexible and innovative with courses and projects and using the university as a test bed and things like that. But yeah, but I definitely have serious roots in the real world.
Well, maybe that's the place to start because, as I read through your book, from one perspective, I was having that disturbing feeling that I sometimes get when things are feeling pretty abstract and high level.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I know that all of this is informed by real-world practice.
Yeah.
For example, when you talk about RosettaNet or when you talk about UBL, the Universal Business Language, it's apparent that you're coming from a background of real experience with...
I helped start both of them.
Yeah, businesses that have implemented those patterns and languages and ways of describing business transactions and are using them. At one point, you talk about, and I think this goes back to 2002, you say that in that year, Intel was doing something like 10% of its business on top of RosettaNet patterns.
Right.
I think it would be really useful to try to connect those ideas and those techniques, which to those of us who mainly just read about them do feel
sure.
Kind of abstract. You know, if you can give us a sense of what the on-the-ground reality is for those kinds of things, I think that would be really helpful. Like in the case of Intel, you know, when you say that these Rosetta PIPs, they're called partner interface.
Yeah, partner interchange processes, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, maybe you can kind of start there and paint the picture. And
yeah. Well, actually, the thing that I'm struggling with these days is that now that I'm in the university, I'm paying attention to more ad hoc or experimental or, should we say, less business-oriented approaches.
Mm-hmm.
I'm struggling with this kind of false dichotomy between, say, mashup versus composite app and microformats versus XML schemas and REST versus industrial-scale web services, and because I'm torn between stuff which I think was necessary to do when I was trying to make a living doing this and building marketplace infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
And where I see all the action is how to find ways to make this thing easier, more bottom-up, more driven by the content producers. And that's a tension I haven't figured out how to resolve yet.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that, because that was actually one of the things I was going to ask you. Is at one point in the book, you say, essentially, you're not going to just take a system that was working internally and kind of hack on it and extend it in an organic way. You know, that you have to go through this intense process.
Yeah, I think I've changed my mind on that a little.
Oh, have you?
In the experience that I was writing about, Commerce One kind of infrastructure experience, it really was one where we were trying often to integrate with people who were doing things with EDI, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And it was essential that you try to think past the syntax and see what people are thinking about conceptually
mm-hmm.
before you can do any kind of integration. Or you may be talking about different things.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of what I've done is trying to do real-world semantics, and the question is how much do you have to do in which context? And that's sort of that's the essence of what I do now, is trying to figure out the appropriate amount of effort in doing semantics for the context that you're in.
Yeah. Well, I had, in fact, you probably met this fellow at our last InfoWorld event. Jim Culbert, do you remember him? Oh, no, he wasn't at the one that you were at. Anyway, Jim Culbert's a guy that's been in the web services game since, you know, before we called it web services. And he said something to me years ago that's always stuck with me, which is that He was the provider of a web service-based billing engine. And what he said to me was that the way it was working was that they would basically compare instance documents in order to do integration. In other words, fundamentally, it would be a conversation about, here's my list of name-value pairs, and this is your list of name-value pairs. Let's put them side by side, have a conversation about what maps to what, and when we get to an agreement, we've done essentially the integration. And that at that point, the distinction was between doing it that way versus this is my API that you will conform to, or you know, I will have to conform to your API,
right,
and
right.
So on. But what motivated the conversation was this comparison of instance documents. The assumption was that then in an iterative way, as new corner cases emerged, well, you would discover them and adapt to them, and that it was not really necessary or desirable to do, sort of a complete thorough, to do the kind of upfront analysis that you describe in the book.
Well, but again, it comes down to this notion of a trade-off. I think I'd center the syllabus for the course I'm developing.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to teach for the first time these courses, which really bring information organization and information retrieval into the same course, which have usually been in different disciplines, one in library science and one in computer science.
Mm-hmm.
And when you do teach them at the same time, you see that it's all about the trade-off of one against the other.
Mm-hmm.
So in the case you're talking about, it's like, well, sure, if I can imagine only a couple of relationships I want to be in, maybe it's a short lifetime, then I can imagine doing a fairly quick and dirty or iterative kind of mapping, because what's the point of investing in serious engineering if it's not going to last that long? But if I have a sense that I'm building the platform for a scalable marketplace where I have a very large number of potential integrations, I can't do them as one-off. I've got to invest up front in a little bit more robust, more horizontal model of the potential integrations.
Mm-hmm. Although then the question is, until you've seen the next partner and the next partner and the next partner, who each of whom brings new requirements to the table, how much in advance can you anticipate?
Well, if you're doing your job right, you send your consultants out and they talk to some of those people and you do some document engineering to inventory the possible partners and figure out how they talk about things. I tend to be a heavyweight kind of guy in that sense. I'm bigger on process than most people, but I see what happens when you try to do it quick and dirty. You end up having lots of ragged edges and things never work. Things never scale because you never get critical mass fast enough. If you can't bring in the community pretty quickly into a marketplace, there's no reason for anyone to be part of it.
Hmm.
So you have to kind of be ready, set, go, where you have to be make it easy for people to connect. So if you're doing this thing one at a time, the first people joining are sitting around with their thumb and then they're saying, when are we going to start having some transactions?
Right. Yeah, I suppose. I mean, the case study that's in the book, the event calendar system at Berkeley, is one of those things, though, that it's funny. I mean, on the one hand, there's nothing mysterious about calendars, and yet on the other hand, they continue to kind of elude us.
Right.
I mean, we know.
Well, you could. Yeah, I'm sure that's overbuilt in a sense, and it's never really been completely deployed, partly because of the unique properties of the university environment. But no, I mean, it's a case where we did a lot of analysis, and knowing when to stop is important, knowing what the context you're really trying to get at.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of thing getting me more interested toward microformats, because there's clearly a case of overinvesting.
Hmm.
You could say, well, how much should I invest in this? And at some point, if you can't deal with the technology adoption kind of problem, people are going to be doing their own thing no matter what,
mm-hmm.
can't impose a good model on people. They're going to have to just do a minimal model, and you'll make do with it. But it's the HTML lesson, right? HTML was not the mother of all data models. It was a simple one, but, simplicity beat out over generality.
It actually has occurred to me that from that perspective, universities make very interesting laboratories for IT, because the heterogeneity of a university environment is not something that's reflected necessarily within an individual corporate enterprise, but is certainly characteristic of the bigger picture, right?
It's a really polite way of saying it, John. I mean,
you get a taste of the chaos of the real world of cross-business integration.
Right, you definitely get the taste of the chaos. The issue in the university is that there's often a kind of inappropriate analogy between the academic part of the university and the operational part. So the CIO, not the current one we have, but a previous CIO at the university would say things like, we can't imagine telling chemistry what kind of research to do, or computer science, or philosophy, so why should we tell them how to run their computer system? Can you sense you're confusing academic freedom with the lack of top-down standards and and requirements. So you have every single unit might have their own way of doing things in terms of IT. So I just say, well, should we have a septic tank and a well and a windmill at my school, or should we be on the grid? And so it means that there's a $100 million organization might really be running as a $101 million organization.
Yeah.
It's very difficult to get things to happen except sort of bottom up. But you can do experiments because no one's going to notice if they fail.
Yeah.
So the ability, I mean, I joke about how the university in some ways runs by a kind of negative Heisenberg principle that, you know, the more you study it, the less likely it is to change. So you can just go in there and do things. That student time constant where you work for a semester, a few hours a week, a project that in the real world you might have got done in 2 weeks, but it didn't get done without you. So you can afford to do things at that kind of student pace. And so it's really great for students to be able to do the university environment in IT. And I've been pretty successful at using the environment as kind of a services research lab, an R&D lab or something. So
that in a way is kind of a liability which can be turned to advantage in certain cases. Then there's this aspect where you have an advantage. And I never really thought about this until I started going up to Dartmouth in the summers for the last couple of years. They have a conference there on PKI and related security technologies. And one of the things I realized is that these folks coming from all of these major universities are in an interesting situation because their user population turns over every 4 years. So they never have to wait longer than that to erase institutional memory from the population of users, right? So if they, you know, if they say we're going to do token-based authentication, 4 years from now, there's no one who remembers, at least in the student population, that it was ever any other way.
Okay, that's a nice observation. That makes me feel better about my problem of the short term of students, which is that when I have graduates in a 2-year program, by the time I feel like I'm able to do any useful work with them, they graduate.
Mm-hmm.
So the other side of that is that you have a short investment time, which is why you tend to do more project oriented stuff.
Well, somebody told me once that I was a document engineer.
Absolutely.
I don't know if that's true or not. You know, I have to say that a lot of stuff in the book is stuff that I don't practice. In particular, the more formal analytical stuff that you talk about isn't really part of what I do. But one part that resonated very much with me was this whole notion of inventorying existing documents and deriving from them both logical data architecture and as well aspects of user interaction and software requirements. This is an observation that I've made often, which is that although we talk about the separation of content from presentation, the fact is that when people fiddle with presentation as they love to do, they're telling us all kinds of stuff about structure.
Sure.
So you have the example of looking at a web page and you can see as a human being looking at the page, well, the fact that this is in bold indicates that there's a section divider here. And the fact that these things are grouped under this heading tells us that there's containment happening. And so although you don't see, you know, if you sort of convert that into its equivalent XML, you won't actually find that structure there. It's apparent to the human.
Right. Well, I guess one of the big ideas of the book is that I try to unify what people call documents, what people call data, and talked about the document type spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really the mixture of, as I say, the content or the semantic information, the structural information, and the presentation or layout information that determines where something naturally falls on that continuum.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, we tend to, when you look at data presentation is often entirely arbitrary, how it's laid out, whether it's big and bold or whatever it is. Whereas on the document end, things tend to be very highly correlated. The bigger things are, the more important they are, and so on. But stuff in the middle is where it's interesting. And that's where I think the document engineering approach of looking at this more nuanced way of analysis makes sense. But one thing before, I want to back up a little, because you talked, you said the document and inventory stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I try very hard to, when I say document inventory, what I really mean is information inventory. Because you get stuff from people as well as from documents.
Mm-hmm.
And the words aren't great because I don't know what to call stuff that you learn from people. Because obviously, if you're learning an interview document or something like that, is a way to make it unified.
Well, Alan Cooper calls it ethnography.
Yeah, I call it anthropology and archaeology.
Right? Yeah.
When you look at documents, you're doing archaeology. When you're doing observation, you're doing anthropology. And you have this kind of mixture because it iterates, right? People will say, these are the artifacts I worked with. And those artifacts may, in fact, mention people or point to other sources. And you need to do both because, of course, the documents may be hard to figure out, but they're not going to lie to you necessarily intentionally in the way that people might or not know. You know, I spent a lot of time doing this work as a consultant when I had a company that was doing electronic publishing. And trying to figure out what the documents really meant and what role they were playing in the organization is very, very tricky.
Well, in particular with all those layers of history embedded in them, like you pointed out, the case where one of the Berkeley course change forms or something like that has, you know, it's kind of like six layers of archaeology in it, such that nobody exactly even remembers why this field is there, but they're afraid to remove it because...
We've always done it that way, right? I mean, there's this kind of inertia, right, in organizations.
Yeah.
I mean, especially in, you know, government and, like, educational institutions, it's remarkable how different they are from the public sector in terms of attitudes toward data architecture. Some of it's good. Some of it is that, you know, we have to be here for the long term. We can't decide to abandon this line of business in the future. We have to still be able to collect taxes and be able to have people vote and be able to have them do this and that.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to have a long-term view of things. And that creates a kind of inertia in the information architecture, which is a good thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, it means that they can easily say, we've always done it this way, and resist improvements of processes that in the private sector you'd say, let's just do something different. This isn't working.
Yeah. Well, I guess one of my disappointments has been over the last few years that what you call the narrative end of the document type spectrum hasn't benefited more from our ability to treat formal structure more robustly in the tools that people use to do their writing. You know, so I was very excited in 2003 when XML capability was injected into Microsoft Word, and I had high hopes for what that would mean. And, you know, one of the things I hoped that it would mean is that we could present to the authors of documents what to them would appear to simply be style sheets. But what we would actually be delivering under the covers is we'd be smuggling schema in, you know, without their needing to know or care about it, because there is that opportunity.
John, in 1992, I had a company called Passive Systems, which helped companies become online publishers, and we would go into Silicon Graphics or Sybase or Tandem or Boolean, whatever other customer base was, and say, right now you're authoring in FrameMaker or Word or Interleaf. If you replace that presentation-oriented style sheet with something more structure-oriented, you could then... creating under the hood, invisibly, an HTML data model, which you could then repurpose and do multiple outputs from the same thing, blah, blah, blah. It was a great idea. We did a lot of it. But the hard problem was getting authors to buy into a style sheet that actually tagged the kind of semantics like glossaried words or references or tables or citations or other product names or chemical names, the stuff that would add that semantic value. And it comes down to this issue of the investment. It's a lot of work to take a paragraph and tag all the internal mixed content as special kinds of stuff. It's much easier to say paragraph here, paragraph here, paragraph. I mean, the tools in things like word process are not bad at the paragraph level, but they're terrible inside the sentence level. They're just cumbersome.
Hence microformats, right?
Yeah, well, yeah. So we're saying, you know what? We're going to just do less granular tagging, and that'll be good enough. And so, see, that's... it's an intellectual position that makes me feel bad, because it says that the tools are limiting what we can do, because we know we can do better intellectually. We just aren't willing to do the crappy little syntax. So, I mean, Emacs mode, those kind of things, much easier to tag inside the sentence. It's just that that's a particular kind of interface that not everyone's going to want to use.
I guess I kind of disagree. I mean, it seems to me that, I mean, let's go back to events. If I'm writing an entry for my weblog and... included in that entry is a mention of an event, and I am aware of some style that exists to wrap an event in my web page such that A, it presents in a certain way, which is branded and identifiable to other people as an event. That alone is, for a lot of people, enough reason to want to use it, because if...
Oh, that's fine. I agree with that. If you could say, when you mention event, bam, have it pop up the four tags you got to fill out. That's easy. That's great.
Mm-hmm.
That would be fine.
We don't have that. You know what I mean?
Well, I mean, part of the problem, I think, is that the microformat idea sounds great. And then you say, well, how many actually are there? There's like seven.
Yep.
So, you know, it's a good idea, but there really aren't that many things you can do that kind of bottom-up, quick and dirty way. There just aren't that many.
Hmm.
We tend to have more rich semantics when we think of things at a more domain level. So we say, let's develop a markup language for pharmaceuticals or for transcripts, or they probably have 10 aggregations of microformats in them. There may be the transcript, there may be the calendar, there may be the student, there may be, but there's sort of a bundle of 10 of them in the more rich schema.
Mm-hmm.
And I like the idea of microformats, but in practice, there's 7 of them. You know, there may be 300 decent, robust XML schemas that are ready for prime time. But of course, the overhead of using them is way more than having your editors to pop up before tags for your event. It comes down to the thing about who does the work and who gets the benefit. If I'm in a company and I'm developing my technical manuals, or I'm trying to do something where I can imagine the payoff to my company and customer support or whatever, I'm going to tag because I see the payoff for me and my firm.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm writing a web page and there's some imaginary user out there who may someday benefit from my stuff, well, you know, how much effort am I going to be willing to put out there? Not so much.
Right. No, it has to be driven, first of all, by enlightened self-interest. So, for example, if you know that there are aggregators and search engines out there that are looking for stuff in, let's just say, those 7 microformats, now there's an immediate incentive for me to publish in that format, which is to say, if I do, I'm going to show up in the aggregation, and if I don't, I won't, or I won't
yep.
show up as prominently. You know,
yep.
So I want, you know, in the same way that people obsess about the meta tags and their placement in Google, it's reasonable to suppose that they'll want to invest, just for selfish reasons, in making sure that they get appropriate placement in microformat aggregators.
Right, and for those 7 things, that probably will happen.
Right.
The problem is, and this is one place where I disagree with you, is that XML is not self-describing. Use that phrase, and that phrase drives me nuts.
I know, I saw that.
Because XML self-describing really means to most people, look at the tag, and that's what it's about.
Yeah.
But if that's what it's necessary, you wouldn't need any metadata, and you're king of metadata.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, you need to have the tag gives you a clue about what it's about.
Yeah.
But if I say date in my thing, does that mean the date the event was created, the date it was going to expire, the date the event's going to take place? I mean, we don't know that,
mm-hmm.
all right? Price, does price mean wholesale, retail, if you act now, you know, because you're my friend, or worst price you could imagine paying if you're clueless?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why the metadata richness, I mean, I know I talk in the book about when you harvest components, how much metadata do you need to decide that you know what something means? And the answer is, it depends on the context.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm doing a quick and dirty thing for myself for one piece of application, fine. It may be self-describing. I know what the tag means. But if I'm trying to create something which is going to be part of a global marketplace infrastructure, I damn well better know what price means.
Then let's come back to this RosettaNet and UBL stuff. There are places in the book where you talk about how you refactored the event calendar design in order to take advantage of some pattern that was described in one of these languages.
Right.
Now, you know, and I get that was, you know, sort of a pedagogical example. But in your real world experience, can you cite examples of how, you know, at one point you say, by using pip number this, that, and the other,
right.
It was possible to condense what would otherwise have been hundreds of pages of technical documentation. But can you make that concrete?
Yeah, exactly. No, in the book, I talk about the use of patterns at different levels of abstraction, from the data level pattern, like what a date means, all the way to like what a supply chain means.
Yeah, or what a drop shipment pattern looks like.
Yeah, the pip level in RosettaNet is really the level that I find the most attractive, as well as the easiest to teach. The example I use in the RosettaNet case is to say, in the calendar case, the problem is we wanted to solve this problem of lack of shared event calendar information at Berkeley, and we could say, what's the right way of thinking about this problem? And you go to the PIP library, where there's 150 little design patterns for business processes, and you can see that some of them are on the supply side, some of them are on the distribution side, and so on. You can just find one and say, well, suppose I think of the problem as a problem of syndication, that somehow information's not getting to the right places.
Mm-hmm.
What kinds of information do I need to have in my model of an event? What kind of processes do I have to have in place to make that work? And what kind of insights does it give me? Or I could look at the pattern on the supply side and said, maybe the problem is that they're not events aren't getting to the right place. People are not creating events in the right format. And you look at the kind of production side, sort of the order management side of the business process. And you can see that in fact is a more appropriate kind of pattern.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell my students, you know, why is it that, let's remember the process by which you register for classes. You know, how come sometimes classes get canceled last minute, sometimes they're oversubscribed and so on? Let's compare that process with the standard pattern in RosettaNet for order management.
Mm-hmm.
What's missing?
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God, we don't have binding commitments. Professors can cancel class at the last minute.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see how these patterns give us real insight, as like giving you almost a template, the meta model for a well-formed process.
So you say at one point, and this is back to the Intel example, when Intel tells its suppliers that it expects them to conduct business with it using RosettaNet pips 3A4, 3A7,
right,
etc., the seemingly unintelligible statement conveys hundreds of pages of technical specifications that define the context of use.
Right.
In practical terms, if I am one of those suppliers,
yep,
what do I glean from this? What do I do differently because Intel has referred me to those RosettaNet?
The PIP specification will tell you the complete choreography of the business process. It'll tell you what things have to be in place for this process to take place.
Mm-hmm.
It'll tell you what the different components of the messages will mean. Once you buy into the idea that there's a business process reference model like RosettaNet, it becomes this incredible shorthand by which you can essentially all agree on how to do business.
Okay.
You know, instead of saying, as you started with, let's send in somebody to do the quick and dirty way of one-offs, there's no one-offs. There's the way of doing it, which entails we're going to follow the PIP as it's built.
Right. So in a case where you have a dominant player who can...
Yeah, for sure. Again, the it's more efficient for Walmart to say, you know, you'll send me this document format with this choreography, or we don't do business.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, there's an investment case there, and so if Walmart's giving you a proprietary model, that may lock you in, and you have to invest only for one supplier. But RosettaNet, Intel is saying, let's use the one that we're all using in the IT supply chain business. And so I think RosettaNet is going to be a very, very important thing across not just the component supply chain, but it's also being used in automotive now and aerospace, because the patterns at some level of abstraction are the same.
Mm-hmm.
Just as you could say there's a latent PIP in registering for class at UC Berkeley, and it would be better if we believed in things like forecast and commitment.
And then how do you relate, or how should we understand Universal Business Language, UBL, in relationship to RosettaNet?
Well, the UBL is essentially an information component model and a document architecture. It essentially says, what is the intersection of all business transaction documents? What is it that order, invoice, shipping notice, delivery schedule, you know, bill of materials, and so on and so on, what do they have in their intersection? And the answer is they have location, time, party, currency, measurement, you know.
Okay.
They have 30 things.
Okay.
Right? And then if we agree on what those things mean and we agree that all documents will be assembled in a certain kind of architecture, then we can all build documents which are going to be structurally and semantically interoperable.
Okay, so you would say UBL is more about the structure?
UBL is the payload model.
Okay,
right?
Okay.
RosettaNet basically says, here's the process specification, and
okay,
when you do business with us, it's really about the process to follow this choreography.
Okay. So these things are completely complementary.
UBL could be the payload of RosettaNet.
Okay.
And in some sense, RosettaNet could be the choreography of UBL.
Okay.
Yeah, that's generally the way people think about it these days. Because part of it, that was the skill set of people who started them. I mean, UBL really emerged out of an effort that we had started at VIA and then at Commerce One called Common Business Language,
mm-hmm,
which was really the first attempt to build this kind of horizontal XML vocabulary. And frankly, I thought we were doing a pretty good job, but no one was going to buy into the idea that some standard business language is going to be coming out of a startup.
Right.
And so we had to get our kind of, in some sense, donate all of our work into a consortium that involved Sun and IBM and a number of other companies.
Well, I was on a panel a year or two ago. I moderated a discussion between Jean Bozak and Jean Paoli.
Yeah, I know both of them very well for a very long time.
Yeah, so this is right around the time when UBL 1.0 was nearing completion. You know, so Jean Bozak was very much interested in that perspective, and you know, this was not long after Paoli had put, you know, user-defined schema into Microsoft Office. So they were sort of coming at it from both ends of the spectrum, you know, and from an Office perspective, the idea was, again, kind of this grassroots, bottom-up sort of thing, you know, that, you know, let a thousand schemas bloom, and because otherwise people are going to tend to not do schema at all, and then let's inventory those sample them and see what can be synthesized out of them, as opposed to trying to do it top down. I guess this is, you know, this bottom up, top down thing is just one of those eternal yin yang puzzles that'll never really, you know, there's no sort of, there's no end to it.
You have to look at these things very, very carefully, because in every case, there's going to be the technical issues about the right approach for some particular business problem. But there's always going to be wrapped into the politics and competitive dynamics of a particular industry.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you could talk about the new, you know, open doc versus, you know, ODF, all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Same way. It's like there are technical issues in the table, and there's all these larger issues about, you know, techno-politics.
Yeah,
I tend to stay away from those just because I'm trying to be a neutral player now. I mean, I'm on the board of Oasis now. It's pretty funny that I'm on the board of Oasis as the kind of academic, unaligned, represent the underrepresented parts of the community of XML people. And I used to be one of the evil vendors in Oasis, and now I'm, you know, this whole other persona I get to play.
And what's your role at Oasis now?
I'm on the board. I mean, about two years ago, after I got to Berkeley. You know, Oasis is this group that essentially is it's an industry group that develops a lot of XML specifications, and particularly in the area of web services.
Yeah, yeah.
And a lot of the verticals.
Yeah.
And I'd been a vendor for years, and all the work we'd done with things like UBL were in the Oasis, you know, milieu. And then one day, I think the Hewlett Packard board member resigned, and a lot of people came to me and said, "You should run for the board of Oasis because you know how the game is played, but you're now an academic who can rise above the fray." And so I ran almost as a lark, but I've actually felt like I've actually been able to make a difference because I am an online person. There's 10 members of the board, and 9 of them are for vendors or something like that.
So what's it been like?
Well, I've helped Oasis as an organization see that while it has members, it also has stakeholders who are somewhat broader than that. So we've been moving toward the open source community, trying to help them understand the role of open standards and open source.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to understand, kind of find ways to encourage more governmental and nonprofit participation, and to find a due structure which encourages that to happen. I'm having a sort of this funny kind of statesman period of my life. I used to be a vendor, and now I get to be a professor and statesman. It's pretty funny. I mean, I went to Berkeley. I never thought I was going to write a book.
Hmm.
I went to Berkeley in the spring of 2002, so it had something to do. And you know, I was asked if I could teach a class, and I said, sure. Next thing I know, I'm trying to write a book that tries to make sense of my life as an electronic publisher and a B2B guy, and I wrote the book. So it's, you know, it's part of it. I have a kind of on-off personality. I haven't been able to figure out where the off switch is.
I am very much fascinated by this idea that there is this, not just vocabulary, but there's this language of patterns of interaction, and you have a bunch of them in the book, you know, drop shipment or contract negotiation. In a sense, it's kind of obvious and common sense, but it yet is unusual for most of us to see these things written down, to see them represented as flowcharts, you know, to see them described as patterns that we should look for in the things that we do and understand and reuse and agree on the use of in collaboration with other people. You know, that just having names for these things, you know, and a common agreement about very basic and obvious kinds of interactions.
Well, but John, it's not so obvious. I mean, you go to the library of books and you can see 10,000 books on web services, and they're all about syntax.
Yeah.
I mean, my book's about making the documents that you exchange make sense.
Yeah.
I look around, I see patterns everywhere. You know, when you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail.
Yeah.
I see document exchange patterns everywhere.
At a more technical level in the web services community, people talk about message exchange patterns, and that goes in the direction of this.
Yeah, but that's still pretty syntactic.
But it's still pretty syntactic, yeah.
About what kind of things form, you know, transactions which can be rolled back and blah, blah. But it's not about what the transactions mean in the first place. There's a kind of, you know, another phrase I've been trying to figure out is semantic literacy. Which I think is a lot of what I've been writing about it for years, and it's about, you know, how do people think about what the world means and whether they're skilled enough to make that really work most of the time. So we've talked a little bit about tagging, and you write a lot about tagging, and I think a lot about tagging, and you know, now that I got this thing about, I want to understand this notion of a trade-off and the investment case for how much you should organize, how much you should tag, I've been looking at things like the range range of tags in different kinds of tagging contexts. Mm-hmm. So if you compare people's tags on Flickr with on something like iStockPhoto,
mm-hmm.
which is, you know, it's a photo site, right? But they're very different. It's obvious. When you think about it, it's obvious, right? On Flickr, people are tagging for themselves or for their friends. And on iStockPhoto, people want to make some money.
Mm-hmm.
And so they publish their photos with tags that are more sort of normative, more objective, more, you know, less clever, less poetic. So they want people to find the stuff. They're not just sort of, you know, tagging for the hell of tagging.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and if you go past that, next, you know, you're doing document engineering, saying, let's develop the markup language for some class of photos. Right? So it's just a continuum. It's like, how much am I willing to invest? And how do I decide? You know, so it's like, I'm trying to understand the kind of, I don't want to say economic, that's too grandiose, but more of this kind of how we understand these trade-offs in terms of, you know, the sophistication that you're able to think about, you know, when to tag and how to tag and why to tag kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I have two different tags. I use Delicious for two purposes. One of them, I started using Delicious to tag the posts on my blog.
Yep.
Because I want them to be found. And I use Delicious to tag bookmarks for my course development.
Right.
So I keep track of stuff I'm looking at, and I use you know, 4-word camel case tags, you know, in my own private, you know, bookmark domain, because I don't care if people find out that it means information in services economy design rules. I mean, that's a very long tag, but no one's ever going to use that tag again, but it makes sense for me.
Yes.
And so I can compartmentalize those two contexts and make different investments on tags in both cases.
Yeah, and I'm using it in much the same way, but I agree that that's probably more mental gymnastics than most people want
to. You know, tagging is hard to do right. It's easy to do easy. It's hard to do right. You know, semantics are hard.
I'm back to these transaction patterns, right? And I'm just looking through. You know, request and response, request and confirm, query and response, notification, information distribution, drop shipment, distribution and fulfillment, contract formation. I mean, these are really rich and evocative terms, but they're also they're relatively easy to understand. What I'm seeing here makes a lot more sense to me than if I approach this from the perspective of the business process execution language or any of those
right.
choreography specifications, right?
Right.
The offer and acceptance pattern, the contract formation pattern and so on are ways of thinking that shouldn't be off-putting to people, right? And that shouldn't be deeply technical, right?
Right. They're conceptual patterns.
Right.
The problem is that the typical developer stumbles into BPEL, something like that, and has to figure out which data item to make the correlational index and tag, and you know, you lose track that you're trying to do business and trying to create a relationship.
How would you recommend that people maintain the proper perspective then, or achieve it?
It comes down to, you know, one of my big jihads about XML, and that is that XML is best thought as an encoding language, not a modeling language.
Yeah.
Too much XML and too much web services is done by slapping tags around APIs and existing data models that may be proprietary. I mean, creating tags on a proprietary crap makes a proprietary crap.
Yeah.
You know, but modeling is hard. You have to make the decisions about how much it's going to be worth and what, is it worth the investment?
Yeah.
And do we do it one at a time, or do we try to invest in a community kind of scheme that we can all understand and interoperate with? And
yeah. But it also strikes me that, I mean, in the IT world, there's been a lot of talk in recent years about bridging the cultural divide between the developer and the, you know, quote-unquote business analyst. And these named transaction patterns are really in the domain of the business analyst, aren't they? I mean, it's really, you know, this is a library of patterns that are in those people's heads primarily.
Right, right. Which is why what we really need in the end is kind of a development environment in which we can work at and some level of abstraction we're comfortable with and have it connect with the other levels.
Yeah.
So it ought to be the case that when you come into a domain to solve some business problem, the guys in the suits, or the women in the suits, can be talking about business patterns and recording that information, and data people can be writing about existing legacy data sources and data schemas, and they'll somehow meet in the middle where they can say, oh, I understand that I'm the payload of your business process choreography.
Mm-hmm.
But you need to have a kind of end-to-end view of that, and we don't teach it that way. We have, you know, library science, information science schools, and we have computer science schools. And you know, you need a place which treats it as a first-class discipline to meet in the middle.
Yeah.
And that's hard.
Yeah.
That's hard.
Here's another one I like, the escalating commitment pattern. It's just a paragraph in the middle of the book, but you say, we see this with business processes used in supply chains where businesses negotiate an intention to supply goods and then increase the commitment as time progresses.
Sounds abstract, doesn't it? But that's, I mean...
But no, I mean, that in fact, it sounds very concrete. It's like, yes, I recognize that pattern. I've seen that thing enacted in various forms. But I have personally not ever, and I bet a lot of people involved in the development of software that supports that have probably never articulated, this is an implementation of the escalating commitment pattern.
Right. Well, my students do.
Yeah.
Because I say, when they're designing something, I make them write these specifications that say, what's the pattern you're trying to implement?
Yeah.
Give me the equivalent Rosetta Net pip.
Hmm.
And they can talk very efficiently about pretty complicated business processes because they learn the vocabulary. You know, you couldn't teach your students how the automotive industry supply chain works because there's just too much domain knowledge to assimilate. But you could say, let's think about when you register for classes. Why doesn't it work? Well, because you have the following problem. You go, let's describe them with some kind of standard language.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really good that way to use the PIPs as a standard description language. And you can then start seeing these things around the world because they're in the world around you, just haven't had a vocabulary to talk about. It's a new thing we're trying to figure out here, but I think it's worth it.
Yeah, this is the challenge. You know, if you listen to Shai Agassi, he talks about, from his sort of long-term perspective, how there are a set of, some low number of thousands of what he calls business objects.
Right.
He's very much about how it is that the standard set of those business objects is going to gradually be elucidated and, you know, from his perspective, woven into the fabric of SAP.
And they follow into 100 business patterns.
Yeah, and that
That's
was
it.
Yeah, and then so exactly, you know, those objects are then embedded in these patterns, and the articulation of them also is absolutely the, you know, one of the central challenges. What is it like to be someone who works from that perspective? Assuming that I've bought into your way of thinking and your methodology, and now, you know, 3, 4, 5 years down the road, I'm in the world of work and I'm practicing this approach. You know, what is it like?
Okay, what's it like
to do that?
All right. So what I always tell people is, you're out there at the warehouse picking up your stuff at the back of Home Depot you just bought or whatever it is you're doing. You close your eyes and say, let me make the buildings go away, and the people go away, and the trucks go away, and just think about who is exchanging information with somebody else. And what does the message say? What does it mean? Mm-hmm. Forget the physical implementation. Just try to focus on the abstraction that this information that's being exchanged between different business parties for some purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And when you do that, you find yourself thinking very abstractly about stuff. And that's where this whole patterns on stuff come from. Like the whole idea of drop shipment. I mean, it is most of the web is drop shipment.
Yeah.
But you never think of it that way because you see all the surface differences, different kinds of goods, different kinds of user interface on web pages. But in fact, there's stuff in a warehouse, there's a catalog on the web, there's someone who delivers it, and someone who takes payment for it, and that's all they are.
Yeah.
Look, John, I think you're a document engineer. You just stop saying things are self-describing, that's all. Do that, we'll give you an honorary degree.
Fair enough. Well, really nice to speak with you again, though. I enjoyed this a lot.
I'm really pleased to be able to talk to you, and I'm very pleased that you read my book so carefully because that makes you one of my students. it's a long book to get through, but I think it's a pretty deep book.
I had to make time for it. I couldn't just breeze through it. I definitely had to carve out some space to, you know, absorb it. But yeah, I thought it got me thinking about a lot of things.
That's great. All right, bye-bye.
Take care.